integrating himself into his own people's traditions and identity, and does succeed cutting the fence, you know.
But that's culture, though, right? It's reintegration into a tradition that's a cultural tradition, as opposed to even, I mean, it's the difference there with between nature and culture is very hard to make.
Well, exactly. I mean, the perception is that that there is a cultural tradition that allows that reconnection with nature. And I think in somebody like Edward Abbey or Wendell Berry, there's the same hope, but not tied to the same cultural traditions. Whereas I'm just not, it's not obvious from the, I think that's true too about environmental literature in Germany to this day. I mean, there's just not this hope that you can really reconnect in that sort of visceral way. I mean, there's much more an insistence that it's always going to be highly mediated, highly modern, highly technologized, and that may not necessarily be a good thing. I mean, as I said, it's not particularly optimistic.
I had a methodological question where you're sort of mapping out eco-criticism. You take a sort of binary between the realism, mimeticism that started the sort of emergence of textuality and concern of textuality. I was just wondering where you saw your emphasis on comparative cultural work fitting into that. I was sort of reading your talk as being sort of mimetically related to history. But then when you sort of turned to metaphor at the end, sort of saw the textuality coming back in. So I just wonder if you see this sort of the cultural comparativism as a blending of those two approaches, or a sort of third thing beyond those approaches, or...
Yeah. That's a really good question, and not I think one that's easy to answer, because I mean I'm clearly the thrust of my argument is away from mimeticism, or from thinking that that environmental literature in any straightforward way registers experiences with nature. I mean, it does that at some level, but I mean my emphasis is on you need to look at what the terms of that reconnection are, what the terms of that encounter are, and those are always cultural. So in that sense, I would not describe my own project as in any way post-structuralist necessarily, but it is a sort of cultural studies approach in that sense, in that it just doesn't accept that there are sort of unmediated experiences with nature, at least not once they get translated into literature or film or internet art. But, you know, I'm not a strong constructivist either. I mean, I think, you know, environmental risks are there, and experiences with nature are undoubtedly there. But I think how they then get filtered and what gets selected, that I think is sort of our job as literary and cultural critics to figure out. So I guess you could describe it as in some ways a weak constructivist position. With a post-structuralist legacy, I mean, I think it has, and especially sort of the Foucauldian part of it, I think has actually had a lot of interesting outcomes and a lot of important consequences for my own work. The sort of really radical linguistic skepticism that's implicit in French deconstruction is something that I don't really find very helpful for engaging with these issues, and it doesn't really get you anywhere. Or for that matter, the really strong skepticism and constructivism that's implicit in something like Niklas Luhmann's systems theory, which has made an impact in social studies of science, not so much in literary cultural studies outside of some Germanists. But that, again, is a very strong constructivist view of society and nature, and one where Luhmann himself, I don't think, really has much of any interest to say about how we might want to address environmental crisis. So, I mean, I share with first-wave eco-critics a sense of, look, we can't go back to just saying, oh, scarcity is constructed and this is all, you know, these are all things that we make up. No, I mean, you know, we're having real problems and we need to address these. At the same time, and there you sort of pinpoint my ambivalence. I mean, at Stanford, I hang out a lot with the scientists and that we have this Woods Institute, which is a wonderful place for collaboration between social scientists and natural scientists. And we have this whole, you know, ecologically constructed new building where all these students run around, you know, wanting to change the world and make policy, but nobody has ever sat them down and made them think about what terms like nature and environment might mean in some of the different cultures that they're called upon to address in their empirical work. You know, I mean, after the tsunami, you know, they sent a bunch of kids to reconstruct habitat in the Andaman Islands, which were very affected. And I was absolutely flabbergasted as I raised my hand and said, but have they learned and you have the language, then do they know anything about the culture and not just about the biological impact of it? I mean, of course they don't. And I mean, I think that's when I then become very culturalist, I guess, and say, look, you can't meaningfully make policy and engage with the world and pretend to change the world if you don't have a clue about different cultural traditions and what how certain things mean culturally and what certain kinds of American discourse sound like when you translate them into German. And, I mean, you have to be aware of that, at least, before you do it. I mean, just to stick with this example. But there are multiple others, of course. And so that would sort of, I don't know if that's sort of the mapping. I mean, I think now there's even the first wave eco-critics, I think, actually many of them have integrated theory in very different ways than they did in the early days. Exactly.
How many waves are there?
two diagnosed so far. I don't know. All this post-colonial stuff. I mean, the post-colonial intervention, I think, could well turn into something that Liz and Allison in different ways are involved in. I mean, I think that could very well become a somewhat different third wave. But, I mean, the first and second wave terminology stems from Lawrence Buell's third book, The Future of Environmental Criticism, where he makes that distinction, and it's it's approximate, but David Mazel is really, in terms of when that book came out, first wave, but it's very Foucauldian, so it doesn't quite fit. But it's, I mean, as a rough distinction, I think it actually makes sense, and it does characterize what are different kinds of intellectual engagement and different kinds of ways of trying to get from literary and cultural theory to sort of real-life eco-activism and ecological issues. Sorry.
So, last question, Alice.
I've been thinking a lot about the relationship between this talk and your book. And in particular, I guess both are so provocative in terms of not only the cultural, historical arguments you're making, but also the formal ones. And I mean, that seemed to be a really important concern of the book, too, that, look, you know, you're also interested in understanding both what is possible formally and what becomes possible in the encounter with certain environmental concepts and crises. You know, you talk about this a lot with white noise and satire, for example. So what, I guess my question is how you understand the relationship between what you're calling here comparative eco-criticism and what you call in the book eco-cosmopolitanism. And I'm thinking particularly about a writer like Karen Taylor Mashita. I'm also, for some reason, thinking about the poet Laurie Nidecker, who on the one hand seems to engage with place-based nature writing tradition of the U.S. in her representation of Wisconsin. On the other hand, the formal influence is European avant-garde. And so, and actually at times in her poetry, there's a very transnational concern with something like war rationing. And so how do those kinds of writers who are so transnational in both their formal concerns and their environmental concepts, how do they work for you or relate to this more comparative in the sense of, you know, two national linguistic contexts that you're bringing together?
So there's a couple of different questions there. I mean, the questions there. The first one sort of as to the difference between comparative eco-criticism to me is a methodology. I mean, that's how you go about things. Eco-cosmopolitanism might be the outcome, or that's something more general. I mean, that's simply sort of an outlook that combines an eye for environmental issues as they play themselves out around the world with an understanding of how they play themselves out differently in cultural contexts. And comparative eco-criticism in the academic context could be a way of getting at that, but that's really much more narrowly sort of academic, scholarly kind of procedure and sort of wanting to make a stab, and that's where I think my project also overlaps with those amongst you who do post-colonialism, of making eco-criticism a much bigger presence in comparative literature, not just in English literature and then in individual literature departments, although English literature is where it's no doubt made its greatest impact. So I think eco-cosmopolitanism describes a sort of a much more general sort of attitude and perspective that may not be academics who hold it. I mean, I think I'm looking for something there that might also apply to people who work for NGOs or, or other people just concerned citizens out there, whereas comparative eco-criticism is a specific intervention in a certain way of doing literary studies and eco-criticism in particular. So yeah, as to so you're right. I'm really really obsessed with questions of form, and in that sense, I guess I'm very very old fashioned in some ways, and.